WBAI, help it pay its bills. You can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go to the WBAI website. That's WBAI.org and click Buddy. So you can become a Buddy. That's a monthly sustainer. $15 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month. Or you could make a one-shot contribution to WBAI to help keep it alive. It's independent radio. Independent media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. So go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 9 a.m. on a Monday morning. Coming up next is Any Monday with David Rothenberg.
Hope my attitude won't bother you, but the day was long and my mood is blue. I couldn't think where else to go. I just dropped by to say hello. Nothing special that I want to say. I just came to pass the time of day. I've told my heart it mustn't show. I just dropped by to say hello. I've forgotten just how sweet our love was, except now and then. Memories fall just like the rain, and I remember when. Well, don't let me bore you anymore. I'm not quite as lonely as I was before. I didn't want the thing you know. I just dropped by to say hello. Quite as lonely as I was before. I didn't want a thing, you know. I just dropped by to say hello.
Oh, Michael G., it's so nice to hear the soulful sound of Johnny Hartman and to be with you live on a Monday morning. Thank you for letting me come back with you.
I'm so happy that you're here, David.
How was the process? You were playing me, but did I come through an electronic tape, some technological aspect that I don't understand at all?
Wait, what do you mean?
Well, in previous, for the last several months, I've been on Monday mornings, a repeat of the Saturday show.
Yes.
How do you get it? Is it a tape? Is
oh,
it a-
yes, yes. Your intrepid engineer on Saturday, he prepares it for me and sends it to me or makes it available to me. And,
but what process is it? Is it a tape or is it electronic thing that I don't know?
Digital format, and we have it, and it's very simple, but it works.
Well, I'm very simple. As I've told you, the only machine I've been able to master is my toaster. Everything else is a battle.
Well, enjoy the toast or the bagel.
I had that this morning. I had coffee and bagel and a banana. Mm. Not all very healthy. Well, Michael, amidst everything else, we look for good news. And I'm so proud of the Fortune Society. I'm reading in the Daily News this morning a new program that aims to provide an exit ramp from the revolving door justice system will boost access to services for New Yorkers in need with a $3 million project from Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office. The investment in the Fortune Society's run program aims to fill holes in the city's social safety net where they're perhaps most clearly displayed. I'm most proud. Our new CEO, Stanley Richards, will be taking over in January. And in our 55 years, Stanley's only the third CEO. I was the first, Joanne Page, for 35 years, the second, and Stanley the third. And I realize that it's, and Stanley is the first formerly incarcerated man. It was never even an issue before, but in recent years, people were saying, why not? But at the last open staff meeting, one of the things that pleased me so much, they gave out certificates for people who had been at Fortune 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and the number of people who have stayed because of their commitment and their passion. And that's wonderful to see in an organization. As far as the program, the Daily News writes, the trained navigators who will work to forge lasting connections with participants have experienced and overcome struggles with the criminal justice system. That's our staff at Fortune, men and women who have done time, have been through it. Health needs and housing themselves, according to Stanley Richards of the Fortune Society. This investment, Stanley goes on to say, reflects a visionary approach to address the underlying drivers of crime and violence at their root, aiming to reduce recidivism and create a safer, more supportive community. And what gives me such naches, you know, I don't know if you know the word, Michael, naches.
I don't.
Sense of pride. Mm. It's a Yiddish word. Is that I sat in a room about maybe a year ago with the new DA, Alvin Bragg, and his staff, and Stanley Richards, and I listened to these two men, one the new district attorney, and one a formerly incarcerated man who had reconceived his life. Stanley is an extraordinary man. And to listen to two men with shared goals about solving problems. And I felt privileged to sit in on that dialogue. It was a getting to know each other. And clearly, Alvin Bragg, who is a different breed of district attorney, has spent time visiting different programs like the Fortune Society, Osborne, the Bridge, and sees us as part of as partners in reducing crime, and you do it one person at a time by creating an environment that allows people to see something else, to go into an environment where they learn to trust and to forgive themselves and to explore the possibilities. I've witnessed it with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men and women who have come through Fortune, who have redesigned their lives, who suddenly realize they can have a life that they deserve, that they never thought they could have. So great pride in this story in the Daily News today, reflecting on a press conference that took place on Friday. I see that Eric Adams was there. I wish he would restore funds onto Rikers Island programs that Fortune and Osborne and other programs were a part of, dealing with men and women coming out of Rikers. That was a terrible waste of under the guise of budget cutting. It's not even budget cutting, because it will increase recidivism. And to maim someone on Rikers Island is a staggering $500,000 a year per person. And to reduce recidivism is to save money, and they've eliminated that. There was one other story in today's paper that caught my attention. Piper Laurie, a starlet who became treated as a serious actress, passed away at 91. I bring it up only because I worked with Pipe. I worked with her. I was the press person on an off-Broadway show a lifetime ago, Piper Laurie and Joe Van Fleet, in a play called Rosemary and the Alligators. It was 2-1 actors, written by Molly Kazan, the real wife of Ilya Kazan. And how I got to know Piper a little bit was that she married a man that I went to high school with, Joe Morgenstern, who was a year ahead of me and became the esteemed film critic at the Wall Street Journal. They were married for a long, long time, and they had a child. But I met, I was with them one night, and Joe was calling her Rosie. And I said, "Where do you get Rosie?" Her real name, Piper Laurie, a name created in Hollywood, was Rosetta Jacobs, a Brooklyn girl who died at 91, announced in the paper this week. And since she touched me at one point, I wanted to call attention and remember her as a fine actress. I'm David Rothenberg. If I didn't say that, and I am, even if I didn't say it, I still am. And as you know, we get you, or maybe you don't know, that we're an insistent raiser of funds because we're listener sponsored, and I get theater tickets. And in the second hour, we'll be talking with John Rubenstein, Tony Award winning actor, the original Pippin on Broadway, Tony Award winner for Children of a Lesser God, who has come back to New York after having been here this summer in a play about Eisenhower. And we'll be talking with John in the second hour. And we do have tickets for this week and next, tonight, actually. And then he has 3 matinees, Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday at 3. And a Thursday at 5. I love that. And Friday at 7 o'clock, over the next 2 weeks. On Saturday, I waxed eloquently how important I thought the play was. It's not only good theater. It's very interesting seeing this interpretation of Eisenhower, one of the last Republicans who you could, and it's difficult to equate him with the Republicans that we see today. And I got this very sharp email from a listener saying, "Don't I know what Eisenhower's role was in the creation of the Vietnam War?" I was praising the play and Rubenstein's interpretation, and also calling attention to the fact that Eisenhower was a different type of Republican. I wasn't justifying his position in any aspect of the creation of the Vietnam War. But I cite that only not because I want to answer every critic, because Lord knows when you're doing a program on BAI, they come in, they hop, skip, and jump into your computer. but that on the left, sometimes we don't listen carefully, or that we don't understand the art of compromise, or we don't understand a good thing when we have it. I had no illusions about Eisenhower. I supported Adlai Stevenson twice, but my point was that I never feared Eisenhower. I never saw him as the enemy. I saw him as a political opponent and a man with whom on many issues I could agree, and whose life I thought was kind of inspiring, very different than Jim Jordan or Donald Trump. So I make that point, and I reiterate that the play is the kind of exciting political theater, not that it's pontificating, but it shows you through Rubinstein's stunning performance, the process in which a man, in this case Dwight Eisenhower, reflects on his military and political life. I found it rich theater, and I'm glad it came back to New York and affording BAI listeners an opportunity to see it and support us at the same time. If you want to give $50 to WBAI, you get two tickets to see John Rubinstein as Dwight Eisenhower. It's at the Theater at St. Clements, and we have tickets this week. And as I said, matinees Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday at 3, Thursday at 5, and if you're a night owl, Monday and Friday at 7, this week or next. And the instructions are you email me, dprfortune@hotmail.com, give your phone number, and when I'm finished babbling today, I will call you and coordinate the theater tickets for you to be among the cognoscenti in New York, seeing Eisenhower. So what a great opportunity, and stay tuned, because at 9 I'll be talking with John Rubinstein about his creation, his very interesting interpretation as Dwight Eisenhower. And Rubinstein, you know, the son of the great classical pianist Otto Rubinstein, famously involved in progressive liberal causes, playing this moderate general. Interesting how and why. We have a second show I want to tell you about, and it comes a little bit later. It's called Telling Tales Out of School. We offered tickets for October. They all went. So we got some more from November. Telling Tales Out of School by Wesley Brown is being directed by Woody King, and it's coming to the new Federal Theater is sponsoring it, which has a long history of plays reflecting the African-American experience. And this has a fascinating premise. It's four women from the Harlem Renaissance who have gotten together after the death of Alain Locke, one of the great writers from that Harlem Renaissance period. And so it's a time when Zora Neale Hurston, Nell Larson, Jesse Fawcett, and Nancy Connard have gotten together. And that's what Telling Tales Out of School is about. All our October tickets went. We still have a handful for Wednesday night, November 1st, Tuesday night, November 2nd, and Wednesday night, November 8th, all at 7:30 at the Castillo Theater on West 42nd Street. That also is $50 to BAI for two tickets. Fiscally and artistically, we're giving you treats. So email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And while you're doing that, I've invited Frank Sinatra, Gladys Knight, and Stevie Wonder to show that along with my babbling, I can give you some very good music.
In my life, I've got someone who needs me, someone I've needed for so long.
watch, unafraid. I can go where life leads me, and somehow I know I'll be strong.
For once I can touch what my heart used to dream of long before I knew.
For once in my life, I won't let sorrow hurt me, not like it's hurt me before.
For once I got someone I know won't desert me, and I'm not alone anymore.
For once I can say, this is mine, you're not gonna take it.
Long as I've got love, babe, you can bet I'm gonna make it. For once in my life, I've got someone who needs me. You can bet I'm gonna make it. For once in my life, I found someone. Yes, for once in my life, I've got someone.
Once in my life,
I've got someone who needs me.
That's from Sinatra's Duets album. It's a song by Orlando Murdoch and Ron Miller. And when you listen to it, don't you wish that Frank and Gladys and Stevie Wonder got together and made 20 other songs? For some reason, they musically bled. Well, each of them are such consummate artists. But sometimes consummate artists getting together with others don't blend. But this, what a magic exchange or magic sharing this is of talents. About 3 years ago, it must have been, I saw a video of Elijah McClain, the young boy in Aurora, Colorado, who was stopped by the police and kept saying, I'm an introvert. And he was shy and semi-geeky and... he looked like the kind of a kid you just want, that a bigger kid should not want to bully but protect. You read that he was a violinist and he worked in a library, and he was a 21-year-old little African-American boy who stopped by the cops, questioned, and he kept saying, please, sir, I'm an introvert. I don't know. It was, the video was heartbreaking. And they called the EMS, and they injected him, and Elijah passed away. He died. And it haunted me, because if you ever saw the video, you would say, why are they, this kid, there's nothing threatening about him. He's the kind of boy, man that you want to shield. And then about a year later, I was talking about the number of deaths by cops, and I was giving a list of the men, and I said, and the kid in Aurora, Colorado, and I couldn't remember Elijah's name. And I said to myself afterwards, that's terrible. This boy died, and he's on a list that you give. He has to, his name and his being has to have some substance. So every now and then I would talk about and gain information about Elijah McClain. And then someone, a listener, sent me this. Colorado officer who confronted Elijah McCain found guilty. Randy Rodema and Jason Rosenblatt, this is the article, detained McClain in 2019 before paramedics injected him with ketamine. Rodema was convicted on two charges and Rosenblatt was acquitted. A Colorado jury convicted one of the two officers charged in the 2019 death of Elijah McClain, a black pedestrian who was put in a chokehold and injected with a powerful sedative and had acquitted the other officer. And when I read that, I suddenly said, I don't have any sense of closure or satisfaction. Yes, people have to be held accountable. Yes, he must be convicted. But does that lessen the possibility of another kid like Elijah being stopped? I don't know. It doesn't lessen my sadness for this boy, man, this child, if you will. And then there's a picture in the thing I sent. There's a picture of Elijah. And if he looks, I almost cry looking at it. It's the same feeling I had when I saw Trayvon Martin. They're just little boys. And they should have been left alone. And they should have had a life. McLean, it says, I just bought iced tea from a corner store in Aurora on the night in August of 2019 when police stopped him. Officers were responding because of a suspicious person because he was wearing a ski mask. McLean regularly wore a ski mask because of a blood disorder that made him feel cold even when it was hot, his family told him. When officers told McLean to stop, he said he was an introvert and asked them, please respect my boundaries. I am speaking. And that's, oh. And it saddened me greatly. And then on Saturday, I read Akeem Browder's op-ed piece in the Daily News. It was the anniversary of the death of his mother, and he reflected on his brother, Khalif Browder, whose suicide after Khalif became the catalyst for the cries to change, close Rikers Island. Khalif was held for 3 years. He was held on $500 bail. The family couldn't raise it. Now they could get $10 million if they had it for that child. And if he refused to plead guilty of stealing a backpack, and he did 3 years and many months in solitary confinement. And when he came out, he couldn't adjust, and he took his own life. And Akeem wrote this tearfully beautiful piece in the news, and I called him afterwards. Akeem is now living in California with his little boy and his significant other expecting a girl soon. And we talked about his brother and his life and his dedicating his life now to ending things like solitary confinement, which destroy the spirit, which is what happened to Khalif Browder. Akeem is a beautiful spokesperson for his brother. And if you have a chance, take a look at the story. And if you can Google the op-ed page in the news from Saturday. We have tickets for something else that you might be interested in. You're not going to see this on Google, and you're not going to be able to get it in the papers, but there is a show that's invited audience only, and BAI people are among those. And it's a group called Food for Thought. And they do dramatic readings. And this is they're doing a series of readings of plays written by Susan Charlotte of trials in which Marty Garbus, the well-known civil rights attorney, was the attorney. And they did one a few weeks ago that many of us from BAI went to see called The Trial of Lenny Bruce. It was, as one man said to me after, no sets, no costumes, just actors reading, and it's the best theater I've seen in 2 years. Because the drama of the courtroom, and with actors like Bob Dishy and Tony Roberts and Penny Fuller in the cast, it's just stunning. Well, they're doing it again because it was so well received on Wednesday, November 15th at the Ethical Culture Society on West 64th Street. And we have a handful of tickets for those of you listening this morning. The People versus Lenny Bruce, Wednesday, November 15th at 2 o'clock at the Ethical Culture Society. So if you want to, that's $60 for two people. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Know that you're getting a special treat. You see, in New York, there's all sorts of, if you lift up the rocks, there are all sorts of things that are not for the general public. And if you look hard enough and you probe, you can get in on the ground floor. So you can do that and see the People versus Lenny Bruce on this November on a November afternoon. I'm going back for a second time to see it. And you're sitting there close to the actors. And then there's a discussion with the playwright and the lawyer, Marty Garbus, afterwards. It's a very unique New York experience. And I'm inviting BAI people to be among the cognoscenti participating in it. And here's Lena Horne with a song by Doobie and Carr.
Cha-cha, happy, but I'm lazy. I don't dig that frantic terpsichore. When I trip the light, fantastic. I don't want to be gymnastic. That's not what a dancing floor is for. What I got in mind is a big improvement with the very minimum amount of movement. Let the other couples push and shove. What I got in mind, I think you're gonna love. Got a new fangled tangle, and there's nothing to it. You just sort of stand there and just sort of do it. You stand close together, there's no wasted motion. A new fangled tangle, an old fashioned notion. The floor may be crowded, but that doesn't matter. It's not necessary to move, don't move, why move? It may be crowded, but that's all the better. It's just like romancing while dancing. Who's dancing? Oh, you start off with one step and cling to each other. And you know how one step can lead to another. Oh, there's nothing wrong with a waltz or fandango, but oh, what can come from a newfangled tango? You cling to your partner and sway to the rhythm. You can't lose your partner, 'cause you right there with him. You don't have to worry about fast or slow steps. The nice part about it, in this dance you don't need steps. You don't have to worry if your dancing won't do. It's not what you do do, it's more what you don't do. You don't need a waltz or a fandango. You just need a man and a new fangled tango. Forget the fandango. Give up the mambo. Do the tango.
Lena Horne certainly knows how to sing a song. Isn't that fun? That one's fun, isn't it? On Saturdays, I do an essay called Out on a Limb, and I repeat it on Monday, and I'm going to do it right now. It's called Out on a Limb. At times, there is so much sadness and pain that I want to retreat, locate a spot of serenity, and shut out everyone and everything. I've watched the protesters on the news, pro-Palestinians, pro-Israelis, and I recall Tony Newley's all but forgotten musical play, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. I'm supposed to take sides, and all I want to do is shout and yell, stop the carnage, the madness. No one will win with this. The streets and the hills will be filled with bodies and an army of innocents slaughtered and wounded, most of whom probably impervious to the political machinations that prompted the onslaught. Back in the 1950s, before I entered the United States Army, I began reading Gandhi and of his philosophy of passive resistance to effect change, to increase opportunities, freedom for all. And he was very involved in India and South Africa, a slow, agonizing venture which eventually produced dramatic change and affected millions of lives. But while at Fort Benning, I began hearing, while at Fort Benning, I began hearing of a minister in Montgomery, Alabama, Martin Luther King, advocating radical social change in that town, using much of what Gandhi had talked about, and indeed observing the words of Jesus, his religious idol. Nonviolent street action was being advocated, similar to my experience in 1952 with the Congress of Racial Equality as a college student in efforts to integrate the people's drugstores in Washington, D.C. And as I was hearing of Dr. King, while I was in basic training at Fort Benning, I was being taught how to be a killer. I was given a bayonet, instructed to yell, "I am a killer," while stabbing a straw dummy. And NCOs, the sergeants, were shouting, "They're gooks," and other anti-Asian slurs. People I didn't know, but was being prepared to hate and kill. It was madness. And my 21-year-old mind was spinning. This was opposed to everything I believed in. I asked to speak to the chaplain the following day, and he greeted me with, "What's up, soldier?" I tried to convey that it was all catching up to me. And the chaplain barked, "Well, what are you doing that they're catching up to you?" And before I could respond, the man said, "Man up, be a soldier." And then I knew I had to figure it out by myself, then and forever after. The system was training young men to hate and to kill. As a civilian, after I left the Army, I watched the wars come, and I marched in protest against Vietnam and Afghanistan, Iraq, the Ukraine, and Israel. I viewed the TV footage of burnt-out villages inflicted by us as the reasons of conflict, control of oil or the land or something that had nothing to do with economic or political power, like the domino theory in NAM to halt the spread of communism. And after they were concluded, the scars of war almost always obliterated the short gains that initiated battle. Is there a way out to end this now going on? This is a time when pacifists and humanists are forced into silence, accused of being indifferent to the photos of blood-drenched victims, as if there's a nobility in justifying war strategies that continue the heartbreak. The time to intervene was before the madness began, the towns being burned, the women raped, the children kidnapped, all the components of recent wars. At some point, the guns will be silenced and the participants, drained and lost, will realize that efforts at solutions are preferable, though when one side is not a government but a mass of enraged, irrational, overlooked men, this path becomes hazy. I'm often shouted at, my perspective unrealistic, as if the brutalizing of human lives is a preferred course. Let me make a side note. Much of my insistent opposition and fear of Trump is because I see him as a manipulator capable of pulling my country apart, violence, an accepted ploy. I witnessed it on January 6th. Not the same as the Hamas bloodbath attack in Israel, but from the same book. How do we halt a fascist here? Is violence our sole option to the stopping fascism in America and impersonating those we consider threats to our democracy? Can we galvanize enough Americans for peaceful demonstrations or rejecting Trump's fascism on our shores? Gandhi and King, two men of peace, were murdered to stop their interventions, but both were threatened frequently during their lifetime and chose not to emulate the architects of hate, and they left us with their wisdom and their passion. It comes down to this: who do we want to be, and in what kind of a world do you want to live in? Revenge is not statesmanship, it's a continuation of evil. Will it stop in Israel? In the Ukraine? I feel powerless. An observer, frustrated that my cries are like thunder in an empty forest and that the warriors will determine our futures. I've stopped watching the news, wondering if there is any sanity remaining. And then I get a phone call from an unknown person seeking help through the Fortune Society. And I make some calls and the world of that single person is cushioned. And I remind myself that each of us, myself included, can make the world better for one individual, one person at a time. And that other world of Putin and Hamas, Kim and Netanyahu and Trump is beyond my reach. And talk to the young man who was once homeless and hungry, but who called me and said, "Hey, Dave, I went to the theater the other night. I got the tickets you gave me. I'd love to go again." And I said, "I'd get him tickets." That's the world I can live in. That's the world in which I want to. That's the world in which I can have a voice. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. Let's hear some music, Michael. I don't even know who's next, but I think it's Lou Rawls, and maybe this song is an appropriate title. Lou, sing to me.
I wish you loved me like you loved me long ago. It was early in the summertime. You said you loved me so. The chestnut trees, the summer breeze, they whispered soft and low. And if I could bring you back again, I'd never let you go. If I were a musician, I would play a sweet love song. And before the tune was through, you would sing along. And every note the master wrote would say that I love you. Oh, if I were a musician, I would play my song for you. 'Cause I love you. Yes, I love you. Maybe I could go on living if you would love me too. If I were a magician, I would make him disappear. I would simply snap my fingers, then he would be gone from here. I'd wave my wand, and from now on you belong to me. Oh, if I were a magician, you'd still be here with me. 'Cause I love you. Yes, I love you. Maybe I could go on living if you would love me too.
The marvelous Lou Rawls giving a stunning interpretation to a song by L. Russell Brown and somebody called B. Vera. I don't know what the first name is. The initial is B. Beautiful song with Lou Rawls, the late Lou Rawls. Seems like everyone whose music I like, I have to precede it with the late. You know, while the Mideast is capturing our attention, the madness in Washington is almost as unbearable. Well, it's not a bloodbath, but it, the implications. Matt Gaetz, every time I say it, I feel I have a bad taste in my mouth. He who manipulated the ousting of Kevin McCarthy has made sounds that he wants to run for governor of Florida. He's from the Panhandle. And I thought, well, that's one good way to get him out of the House. But my sister lives in Florida. Do I want him to be the governor of a state in which my sister is living? Can he just retire? Or can't they continue the prosecution on the sex charges against him? That would be nice. Can we convict him of something? Ay, ay, ay. And then Jim Jordan, he doesn't have enough votes. They had it, I guess, tantamount to a straw poll. He's leading to be the House Speaker. Can you imagine Sam Rayburn, Tip O'Neill, Nancy Pelosi, and Jim Jordan? Do you realize what Jim Jordan represents? Oh, have you ever heard him? He rants. He's unprepared. I watched some congressional hearings. He's unprepared. He comes in late. He rants and raves, and he's never familiar with the subject at hand. And he wants to, and he's a Trump supporter. Well, a big Trump supporter. So that's what we're facing in Washington right now. What I would like to see is a half a dozen moderate Republicans switching over and voting with the Democrats, who will be in unanimity and have Hakeem Jeffries be the speaker. That's not going to happen. I can't imagine six Republicans. But maybe a half a dozen Democrats could go over and vote with the Republicans to get a moderate. Or get. Can you imagine, I'm saying this, to get Kevin McCarthy back? He's starting to look better than everybody else that the Republicans are offering. I mean, which poison do you want? Way-yay-yay. Tickets for another couple of things for you to see and support, listener-sponsored BAI. Do you remember Sean Young? She was a very prominent young actress in the screens 20, 30 years ago. Starred with she was the leading lady with Harrison Ford in Blade Runner and No Way Out with Kevin Costner. Well, she's coming off Broadway in a play called Ode to the Wasp Woman. I love the premise of it. It's about four different people who were cult classic B-movie people, and it's about the end of the line for them. The four people, she's playing Susan Cabot. Susan Cabot was in Roger Corman. Some of you might not, if you were movie buffs, you'll remember what I'm referring to. Roger Corman once had a cult classic called The Wasp Woman, one of the most awful movies, but they were human beings who were actors who may have aspired to be Lady Macbeth or Macbeth and ended up in careers that become punchlines for bad jokes. So this is about four of those people. Susan Cabot, who was the Wasp Woman. George Reeves, who was in the first television Superman. There was no special effects. It was... And he always looked a little chubby, if I recall. He was bursting out of his Superman uniform. Then there's Alfalfa from the Argonne comedies. And then the queen of the B-movies was Barbara Payton. I remember her. She was famous for having the longest kiss on the screen with a man named Hugo Haas. And why I remember it, she was blonde and busty and irrelevant. Well, here's a play. It's called Ode to the Wasp Woman. And it's about these four folks, and there's music, and it's an homage to actors who, I don't know, compromised, but ended up being cinematic asterisks, if you will. It's ripe for good theater, and it's a new play coming to New York, and it's called Ode to the Wasp Woman. Wasp Woman. And we have tickets for it. It's when does it start? We had a good response to it on Saturday. Ode to the Wasp Woman's. We have tickets. Where is it? Starting Monday, October 30th, and then Wednesday. I think the Wednesday matinee is gone. And where is the? All right, talk to yourself for a minute while David gets his life organized. Ode to the Washwoman, a Monday night at 7:30, the 30th, and then Thursday night, the 2nd, and then Saturday and Sunday matinees at 3 o'clock. $50 to BAI, and you get a pair of tickets to Ode to the Washwoman. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, and you get two tickets. We also, for those of you who are aficionados of good dance, as you must know, that the Joyce Theater is the dance capital of the galaxy, as far as I'm concerned. If it's at the Joyce, it's wonderful. Linda Shelton finds companies from around the world. Make a return engagement is the Sankei Juko from Tokyo. And what they do is an evening of provoking an homage to the rich legacy of Japanese dance theater. And you can, you know, the wonderful thing about things coming to the Joyce dance companies, you can always Google and see 5 or 10 minutes of them and see some of the most exquisite movement of athletic and grace in the dances, particularly those from Japan. Sankei Juko, we have tickets for their opening night, Tuesday the 24th. The Wednesday tickets are gone. Thursday, we have tickets, and then the following Tuesday and Wednesday. The Joyce Theater is on 19th Street and 8th Avenue. Their quality is impeccable, the best dance you could find. And a $60 gift to BAI, and you get a pair of tickets. So let's hear from Lee Wiley, and then we're going to talk about hearing from our guest, John Rubenstein. But let's hear Lee Wiley in the meantime.
Chicken today and feathers tomorrow. One day it's good, the next day there's sorrow. I don't care what, long as I've got my guy. Chicken today and feathers tomorrow. One day I lend, the next day I borrow. I don't care what, long as I've got my guy. I'm like a river rolling along, a lonely river singing a song. And where my hat is, that is where I. Chicken today and feathers tomorrow. One day it's good, the next day there's sorrow. I don't care what, long as I've got my guy. I'm like a river rolling along, a lonely river singing a song. And where my hat is, that is where I belong. Chicken today and feathers tomorrow. One day it's good, the next day there's sorrow. I don't care what, long as I've got my guy.
Lee Wiley, on a, who wrote that? That's a nice song, isn't it? Do I have it right down? Johnny Marks, whoever he be. Last Sunday, I moderated a forum at the Ethical Culture Society on systems babies. The participants, Barry Campbell and Casimira Torres, were stunning and startling. These are two of my close friends, men I met through the Fortune Society years ago. I have learned their stories, their incredible childhoods of deprivation, raised by the state in both cases, and broke through and somehow have become remarkable healers and counselors. But if we really want to understand crime and the cause and effect of crime in our society, I would invite you to take a look. You can watch the discussion. It goes for about 45 minutes. The insights and the humanity of Kaz Torres and Barry Campbell are stunning. You go to the fortunesociety.org website and you find Systems Babies. It's right there at the top. And I promise you, you will be, well, the word is not entertained, but you will certainly be enlightened, and knowledge is power. I want to also tell you that the Sing Sing Prison Museum up in Ossining is having a screening of Stanley Nelson's nominated for an Academy Award as Best Documentary, Attica. It's on Thursday night, November 2nd, at the Boudars Theater in Ossining. There's a talk back afterwards with director Nelson and Tyrone Lawkins, one of the Attica brothers. And you just go to ossininglibrary.org for information about that. I want to tell you about more tickets that we have. Some of you have been listening because we're getting some calls, people wanting to see things. Here's a new play coming in by Michelle Close Brooks. I interviewed her. She wrote a play several years ago about, what was the exact title? Hitler's Tasters. And it was very, and then I found out Michelle Close Brooks is Mel Brooks's daughter-in-law. It's very interesting that her plays are so theatrical and so dramatic. And but she said she gets great support from her father-in-law. War Words is, boy, is this, it's so relevant right now. It's a docuplay in the war. She's interviewed men and women who served in the military during the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars and has created a dramatic piece based on their words of the 20-year war with a cast of prominent New York actors. And it's coming to the Art Theater on West 53rd Street starting November 10th. I wanted to give people an early start on it, Friday, November 10th. But, you know, when I heard about it, I said, this is a play that BAI people will want to hear to understand. Just as I said that the interview with Barry Campbell and Kaz Torres gives you some insight on causes of crime, so does the words of people who have been in the military tell you about the reality of war, not the John Wayne version. War Words coming off Broadway starting Friday, November 10th, and we have Saturday and Sunday matinee that first weekend in November and the second week in November. War Words. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com and give you a phone number and I'll call you back to make sure you are have an opportunity to be among the first to see this play coming. I'll be interviewing Michelle in a couple of weeks, and I want you to stay tuned for that. All right, let's hear from John Rubenstein. Before he was Eisenhower, he was Pippin on Broadway. And here he sings from Pippin while Michael Haskins will be calling John and hooking us up to talk about Dwight D. Eisenhower. Here's John singing Morning Glow.
To glimmer when you know winds of change are set to blow and sweep this homeland through. Morning glow is long past due.
Well, that was John Rubinstein wearing another hat. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I was wearing a crown in that one.
You were Pippin in that.
You bet.
It sounded beautiful. Beautifully. We talked this last summer before you had started performing, and I had not seen you as Dwight Eisenhower. And of course, I have a whole different perspective now, having seen your stunning performance in this thought-provoking play. And I wanted to start by telling you this. When I saw it, my guests were former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy and his daughter. And afterwards, we went out for dinner, and we couldn't stop talking about the play. And he was texting away. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm texting Chris Christie, telling him he has to come and see this. And I said, well, he's running for president. I don't know if he's going to find time. But it prompted me to wonder, have political people, particularly Republicans, introduce themselves to you afterwards and having any insight about that man at that time in the Republican Party today?
No, to be honest, they haven't. That doesn't mean they haven't been there. And I've talked to so many people, both in Los Angeles, where we started this play, and here since we've been doing it since the summer. And I have to imagine that a bunch of them were or are Republicans who were maybe even surprised to hear one of their guys talking with such heart and humanity and concern about people.
I did get an email from a listener who said she was sitting with a woman who turned out to be Herbert Brownell's either niece or granddaughter, Brownell being Eisenhower's attorney general. Did she come and talk to you?
I didn't manage to meet and talk to her, but she did come and she conducted a question and answer talk back after one of our performances.
Well, I got this secondhand from the listener who said that it was fascinating, not only her validating, but her having met Eisenhower, that it was very interesting and profound to see your interpretation, which is part of an actor's, when you assume the role of Pippin or Children of a Lesser God, you're creating something from the page. When you're creating Dwight Eisenhower in the memory of people my age and in the history books of younger people, you have to approach it very differently. And one of the things I said as I waxed eloquently in my review was that you didn't impersonate Eisenhower, you implied him. And I'm wondering how you go about that.
Well, you know, to be really honest, it's the playwright. When a playwright, I mean, can you imagine being assigned the task of writing a 2-hour monologue for Dwight Eisenhower for the stage and making it somehow theatrical or interesting? I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know how to do it. Our playwright, Richard Hellison, found a way to not only find a device, which is Ike talking into a tape recorder and recording, and the other device of having just read in the New York Times that he is ranked number 22 out of 35 presidents, having just left office a year earlier. And so he's angry, and so there's an energy there that he has. He found the vernacular, the kind of Midwestern phraseology, the way Eisenhower would construct a sentence, how he would add a little, well, you know, a little introduction to a sentence. And so the actor's work is mostly done for him by the playwright. I if I could just find that accent, which was relatively easy for me because I know a lot of people from the Midwest, some I've spent a lot of time with. And I immediately listened to tapes of Eisenhower and found that I could do his voice. It's not exactly an imitation or a mimicking of his exact sound, but it's definitely his twang from the middle of the country. And once I found that and had those great words as written by the playwright, the culling of Eisenhower, the man, wasn't really a big job. It wasn't very difficult.
Well, you know, when I saw it, I told you we went out for dinner afterwards. And sometimes you go out for dinner and you talk about the weather and what everything else. We couldn't stop talking about the play, the implications and how it affects today and the reshaping of the Republican Party. And when I said that on the air, I got so many emails from listeners who had gone to see the play who said the same thing, that afterwards they had to talk about it, that as people of political with interest in the shaping of our country, that the things that came out about Eisenhower and about the country at that time and what he wanted, what they almost had to. They had to get there, you know, grapple with it. And I'm wondering, as the actor recreating this president, this general, this hero, has it changed? And you, a progressive Democrat, as you've indicated in interviews, how do you assess his role historically and your response to him?
Well,
that's an essay question.
Yeah, it's a big one. I get very moved by the play itself every night. I get moved by the idea of a man who was so powerful. I mean, you know, if you're the president of the United States, no matter who you are and what kind of a character you are, you have tremendous power at your hands. And you can argue the same is true of a president of Columbia University, who has enormous influence over faculty and students in one of the biggest and greatest universities in this country. And you can argue that a five-star general commanding a huge military organization in a world war equally has gigantic power. And so here's Eisenhower, who was all three of those things in his life, and yet managed to be humble, that's who he was. His job in each of those circumstances, and as the first commander of NATO, putting all those European countries together, was humble. It was to make life better for the people he was in charge of, whether it was the soldiers he was sending into battle or the populations of the European countries he was trying to assemble for NATO, or the students at Columbia, or everybody in the United States as president. He cared about them, and he wanted to make their lives better. And we don't really hear that very much anymore. I do believe it about Joe Biden. And, you know, I'm concerned with everybody else about that. He's very old. He would be the oldest. You know, he is the oldest president, I think, right now, isn't he, that ever has been?
And, well, he's almost as old as me, and that's old.
You know, but you can talk about the way he talks, that his voice slurs a little bit here and there. But he knows exactly what he's talking about, and he's very aware of what's going on, and he's making very difficult decisions.
You're making a comparison between Eisenhower and Biden. You know, I've gotten a couple of emails from listeners saying, stop praising Eisenhower. He did this, he did that, you know, particularly in Vietnam. And I've said, well, what I'm praising, I'm not praising him, as in fact, I supported Adlai Stevenson, but I have a different view of him. I'm praising the play, the interpretation, the learning the history of our country at that time with a perspective I didn't have. And also that Eisenhower, even those of us who were Democrats never viewed him as the enemy, he was the political opponent. That's very different. How would you answer somebody who's screaming, stop praising Eisenhower?
Yeah, well, because people want dirt. And sure, Eisenhower did things where the repercussions were not beneficial to the world or to anybody, as pretty much any CEO and any boss does. I'm sure he made some decisions in World War II that didn't go exactly as he wanted them to go. So, yeah, people want to criticize. And Democrats today, and I'm certainly one of them, have to some degree adopted that us against them philosophy, that approach to politics, where it's not he's just a political opponent. He's the other. He's the bad guy. He's the enemy. Mm. And that's why our Congress is in complete disarray. And there's so much hatred in this country being inspired, being fomented by people like Donald Trump. He wants everybody to hate everybody. Lock her up. Lock her up. There's no respect anymore.
John Rubenstein, if Dwight Eisenhower came along today, how do you think, based on, and you're probably as informed about him, playing him every day and studying about him, where would he fit in today politically, do you think? Would he be a healer? Would he be a compromiser? What?
I think he would be absolutely a healer. He would probably be who he was then. He would, you know, on the political spectrum, the way it is now, he'd probably be a Democrat. He never cared about Republican or Democrat. He became a Republican because that's what was available to him, and he was trying to stop Robert Taft, who was an isolationist, very much like many of our, you know, presidential candidates right now in the primaries. And so he adopted the Republican Party because that's what he had to do in order to do that. But
well, that's one of the fascinating things in the play in which you're playing Eisenhower is that both parties were wooing him. And he saw Taft as a possible, not only the Republican nominee, but the president. And so he knew he had the popularity to stop him. That's kind of an interesting political choice that comes out. One of the many things that came out in the play that, that we today should know about him and how he shaped the country. What, in other way, what other ways has he shaped our thinking or our the politics that he espoused having a lingering effect?
Well, I mean, I feel sort of heartbroken to answer your question by saying that much of what he did and the effect that he did leave behind have been stomped upon by his successors, Nixon, first and foremost, and no, not foremost, but first, but foremost, Reagan, Ronald Reagan, you know, lowered the taxes for all of the more wealthy people. And under Eisenhower, the taxes for rich people were very high. They were in the 90th percentile. So that was huge. They paid huge taxes. And that was the period when the country was at its best, when the middle class grew, and there's still, of Eisenhower's effect, there's still a lingering respect and love for the, in quotes, middle class. But thanks to Ronald Reagan and his successors, Newt Gingrich, who was never president, and the two Bushes, and not to even begin to talk about Donald Trump, who never should have been anywhere near the presidency, that middle class has diminished, and now people are struggling. In Eisenhower's day, a couple, one of them could work and the other one could stay home and take care of the kids, and they could still afford to have a car and a refrigerator and a TV and have a vacation somewhere. Now, both parents have to work, sometimes two, three jobs, and they never see their children, and so they need child care. All of this started with Ronald Reagan.
Undoing Eisenhower. John Rubenstein, there's still Eisenhower people around. I mean, we knew David as a young man, who married one of the Nixon girls. Have any of the, was David his son or his grandson?
Grandson.
Have any of them come to see the play, or have they given any nod of approval? Any Eisenhower relatives around?
I was very honored and excited to meet Susan Eisenhower, David's sister, his granddaughter, who came to our opening night back in June. And I had just read her book. She wrote a book about her dad called How Ike Led. It's a very, very interesting book because it's about the crises that he had to face. It's about the most difficult decisions he was stuck with. And she analyzes those and talks very much personally about him and his behavior and his life. And so she came to the show, and she loved it. And another granddaughter that I didn't meet came, and I was told that she said, "Oh my gosh, it was like being back at Gettysburg when we were kids. We lived
isn't that
there."
Wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Let me let you go on this one. You're here from a limited engagement, and you didn't at L.A. It should be done on every college campus in America. Is there any chance of this or being televised, PBS or anybody? I want more people to see Eisenhower. I think more than ever, we should have a sense of this man. And you present it in this play. And I'm wondering what the future of it is.
Well, you know, I have another engagement to do it near Los Angeles, back in California, in February and March. And there are a lot of people working on exactly what you're proposing, getting it to universities, getting it to, you know, to theaters around the
country.
You
want to do it, then?
You know, I'm just a hired actor. I feel very honored and lucky.
No, you're a pretty good hired actor. I'd love to see it in Abilene and down in Texas where he lived. People
yeah.
who have lost what Ike brought, that they should hear.
I agree with you 100%. I want to do it in Washington, D.C., where at least some politicians will come, both Democrats and Republicans. Republicans may be saying, finally, there's a play about one of our guys. And they'll show up.
I think you should do it in the House, and that you should be up on the – you should do it – you could do it in the House because you don't need all the accoutrements that many productions have. You could just be Ike in the House and tell the story. Wouldn't that be exciting?
Sure. We're going to do it up at Columbia University specifically for the Council on Foreign Relations.
Oh, really?
November. When? November 4th.
That's great. That's not open to the public, I assume.
They are setting it all up for it. Huh?
That's not open to the public.
I don't know. I doubt it.
Well, the public has a lot of chance to see you at St. Clement's, and after you hang up, I'm going to tell them how they can go about it. It doesn't matter what venue they're at, but they have to be at it to see your stunning performance as Dwight Eisenhower and a new view of our own history, which is so significant. And as so many of our listeners have emailed me, to come out of the theater and to want to just talk about it and explore it and the implications. That's exciting when the theater doesn't end while you walk up the aisle. So for all the theater goers that listen to this program, I thank you for the performance and for joining us this morning, John Rubenstein.
A great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Let's hear from Frank Sinatra, and then I'm going to tell you how you can get tickets too. Eisenhower, this piece of ground.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do, except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do, but I get along without you very well. I've forgotten you just like I should. Of course I have, except to hear your name or someone's laugh that is the same. But I've forgotten you, just like I should. What a guy, what a fool am I, to think my breaking heart could kid the moon. What's in store? Should I phone once more? No, it's best that I stick to my tune. I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except perhaps in spring. But I should never think of spring, for that would surely break my heart into.
Hoagy Carmichael wrote that. Nelson Riddle's arrangements are stunning, and Frank Sinatra would make you want to cry listening to that song. Eisenhower with Tony Award-winning John Rubinstein. For the next 2 weeks, Monday nights at 7, Wednesdays at 3, Thursdays at 5. Isn't that interesting? Fridays at 7, Saturdays and Sundays at 3. I promise you that you will go and see this really rich performance, and one that should be seen over and over by around the country. It's part of our history, his interpretation as Dwight Eisenhower. Yes, Dwight Eisenhower did some things in his policies in Southeast Asia that led to the Vietnam War, at least supporting the French improperly. He also brought a humanity and a heroic aspect to it. But it's not about the man. It's about theater that forces us to discuss and stimulate and argue and to come to terms. And that's when the theater is an agent for social change, or a theater is an agent for social reflection, I cheer for it. So I invite you to come and see Eisenhower, this piece of ground. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give you a phone number, and I'll get back to you today and make sure that you see this important piece of theater. I hope that it ends up on PBS or whatever people are watching these days, so that there's that other a balance. How much Trump can you see? I have a question. I keep reading about the trials of January 6th, and something dawned on me. All of those men, mostly men, almost overwhelmingly males, were there and for 3 days. What kind of jobs did they have? What was their employment, and how did they get out of work for 3 days? And were they all blue-collar people? I do know this, that somebody who's incarcerated in a New York State prison said two of the guards took off for 2 days and went down to Washington and went down and were among the lawbreakers that went in. They weren't indicted. They weren't apparently not identified. But when they came back to the prison, the state prison in upstate New York, they received standing cheers by their colleagues, the other guards. Interesting observation, is it not? And then you wonder about America. I hope that there are people that were listening that will take place about, will take advantage of our offering of tickets to Eisenhower. I think it's important. Earlier, we announced, what else did we announce tickets for everything that's playing. It's all over the place. By the way, I saw Joan Crawford in between football games last night. I saw Joan Crawford in This Woman is Dangerous. You know, my friend Julie Halston, who one of the funniest women on the planet, always reads from Joan Crawford. And she says that the key to a Joan Crawford movie is when she slaps a man across the face. So I always wait for the slap. And last night I stepped out in the hall for a second and I heard a slap. And I said, I want my money back. I heard her slap, but I didn't witness it. It was a big day for sports fans yesterday. For those of us who don't want to watch the news, the Liberty won. There was so much football going on. I only got glimpses of the Liberty. I wasn't hopeful, but they won quite swiftly over the Aces from Las Vegas. So now they're down 2-1. The Jets upset the Bulls, and the Giants, of course, lost to who did they lose to? No, the Jets upset Philly, the Philadelphia Eagles, who were undefeated. The Giants lost to the Bills. First half on the 1 yard line, couldn't get it across. Should have smashed the ball down and kicked the field goal. Very frustrating. The Giants seem to invent new ways to lose. You know, the Yanks and the Mets faded so quickly that the Major League Baseball playoffs sort of, at least for me, don't seem that interesting. Although Philly against Arizona, Philly's defeating of Arizona, of Atlanta, picked me up. The highlight, though, of the weekend was there's a play now. Well, it's always been there. When there's a short, you know, they only have 1 yard to gain a first down. Everybody gets behind the runner and pushes him over the mark. And they're now calling it the tush push. I think that's to watch network television and saying they're implementing the tush push. There's something else I've observed watching sporting events, particularly college games. I've been there and I've seen how it happens. It looks like the students are all hysterical, screaming, making faces. They're all putting up their fingers. We're number one. And they're doing everything but showing their naked hineys to get on television. Well, what happens is that the cameraman instructs them. And if they don't act like imbeciles, they don't get the editor doesn't make the director doesn't make press the button. So it conveys the impression that only imbeciles are on the college campus cheering their teams on. It's such an ugly display of youth. And of course, then there's the cheerleaders and they are instructed to wave the pom-poms. It's nauseating. And that's my sports bulletin for the day. Let's hear from a return engagement from Lena Horne as she sings a song by Fats Waller and Andy Razoff.
Every honeybee sighs with jealousy when they see you out with me. I don't blame them. Goodness knows, honeysuckle rose. When you're passing by, flowers droop and sigh, and I know the reason why. You're much sweeter, goodness knows, honeysuckle rose. I don't buy sugar.
Does it get any better than that musically? Lena Horne, LaFats Walla, and Andy Razoff. If I were 30 years younger, well, what I could do if I were 30 years younger, I would produce a musical review called Andy, The Songs of Andy Razoff, virtually unknown, grandson of a Madagascar prince who wrote some of the best songs in the outgrow of the Harlem Renaissance. He wrote with Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, and some of his songs are just beautiful. I thank Bobby Short for introducing me to him. Words. I'm fascinated by words. How do they become popular? How do they become irrelevant? How do they get misused? I remember, you know, 20 years ago, I started hearing everyone saying like, and I said, if I was writing a book about that generation, I guess whatever generation that was in the turn of the century, I would have titled it I Was Like, because I stood on the subway and sat on the subway and listened to two young women. I had no idea how they understood each other, because I was like this and he was like that and I was like this. And then they made that face, that mouth open. And I said, how are they communicating? All they're saying is like. And then there was the man who came up to me in the supermarket it was a woman who said, do you know where I can get like, Tide? And I said, why don't you just get Tide? It's just as good. She didn't know what I was talking about. Where did who taught them that? It wasn't taught in school, which proves that we can teach people things. Then the word totally. Do you agree with me? Totally. It's become all consuming. I don't get it. Awesome. I've stopped using awesome because everything is awesome to the current generation. And the word so, S-O, not S-E-W, so. He was so busted. He was so put out. Now that's good use of it. I was so, you are so busted. You are so it's overused. The word weep. No one weeps that I know. They cry. They sob. Only in books do people weep. When I hear a Sinatra singing, I Get Along Without You Very Well, I get misty-eyed. I don't weep. I write about weeping. And recently, are you aware of the use of the word agency? I used to think that the FBI, NAACP, they were agencies or organizations that could have been agencies. Suddenly, I first heard Jane Fonda talking about something about the agency, and now I'm reading a book and it's used over and over again. Agency meaning what? Power, control? It's suddenly sweeping like a bonfire. How do words this is the point where I should play Pete Seeger's English is a Crazy Language. It really is kind of fascinating that how a word becomes not taught, but used, which makes me wonder why we can't do better with grammar and vocabulary in the schools, because people are quick to pick it up. Sounds like bounty, doesn't it? The quicker picker up. So we have a couple of things that I did tell you about, and I want to tell you about again, theater tea for you to see. Telling Tales Out of School. We just have the tickets for it through October went so quickly, and we have a couple of dates in November. Wednesday the 1st, Tuesday the 7th, Wednesday the 8th. It's about four women from the Harlem Renaissance that had met after the death of Alain Locke, who was one of the prominent people in the Harlem Renaissance. And the Telling Tale Out of School by Wesley Brown, being staged by the wonderful Woody King, the talented Woody King, and Zora Neale Hurston, one of the four women, being played by Elizabeth Van Dyke, as she did when she did her stunning one-woman play about Zora Neale. But it's four women from the Harlem Renaissance, Zora Neale, Jessie Fowler, Nancy Cassard, and Nella Larsen. History, part of history of the Harlem Renaissance in a play, reflecting. It's at the Castelia Theater. It's under the auspices of the New Federal Theater. Just a handful of tickets left during that first week of November. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And the other day, I played some Harry Belafonte records, and it reminded me that when his movie, Sing Me a Song, a documentary about his life, when it came out, I interviewed Harry on BAI. And it was insightful. And of course, this extraordinary artist who became close to Dr. King and a major activist for social change and for civil rights. I'm so proud of that interview. And we have that interview and the movie, Sing Me a Song. For $60, you can have both. And it's supporting the station. So if you would like a copy of Belafonte on film and in an interview with moi, email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your name, give your name, David, and your phone number, and we'll get it to you. Well, musically, the song At Last, you know, there are certain songs that belong to an artist. Over the Rainbows, Judy Garland's. Pick out some others. Sentimental Journey is Doris Day's. At Last is Etta James. And so I've always been hesitant to play other people singing At Last. But Lou Rawls, who can do no wrong in my book, teamed up with Diane Reeves. And, you know, the startling thing about At Last, you think it's this new wave, the old movie team of Harry Warren and Matt Gordon wrote At Last. Listen to Rawls and Diane Reeves. This is a beautiful interpretation. And while you're listening to them, you can email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, supporting BAI and getting you to the theater.
Like a song.
Ooh, at last, the skies above are blue. My heart was wrapped in clover the night I looked at you.
Found a dream that I could speak to, a dream that I can call my own.
for you are mine at last.
Press my cheek to a thrill that I have never known. You smile, and then the spell, it was cast, and here we are.
Well, that's as good as it gets, isn't it? Lou Rawls and Diane Reeves. Harry Warren and Matt Gordon wrote that. Well, it's time for me to review all the theater tickets that we offered today. At least that's that which is left, and I'll add one. I didn't mention that we have one pair of tickets left for an opera. The Teatro Grattacielo finds overlooked operas, and they do a couple a year, and they're doing Spontini's La Vestale at the Gerald Lynch Theater at John Jay College on Saturday, October 28th at 6:30. It had a spurt of life when Callas decided that she wanted to do it and did at the Metropolitan Opera. But now it's being done, and you can be among the cognizant seeing it on Saturday the 20th. We have one pair left. Indra Thomas is playing Giulia in Spontini's La Vestale. For you opera aficionados, what a rare chance. Saturday, October 28th, 6:30, 59th Street and 10th Avenue, the beautiful Gerald Lynch Theater. You email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. We have one pair left and one single left. That's what's left for that. And for those of you who are culture mavens, at the Joyce Theater, the stunning Japanese theater troupe coming, the Sankai Juku coming to the Joyce Theater, where dance is, well, New York is so lucky that we have the Joyce Theater because the best in the world come. And this dance company does a homage to the rich legacy of the Japanese dance theater. And they open October 24th on a Tuesday, and we have tickets for that Tuesday and Thursday and the following Tuesday and Wednesday. That's also $60 to BAI for a pair of tickets. If you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And of course, if you were paying close attention, you heard John Rubinstein, whose performance as Dwight Eisenhower is to be treasured for theatergoers and for people who want to see theater as part of our mirroring history and the political and social changes that the theater can mirror. Eisenhower at the Theater at St. Clement's all this week and all next week, with matinees on Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. $50 to BAI for a pair of tickets for that. And, that's enough for right now. Let's hear from Lee Wiley. And before we go out, I may have time to tell you about a couple of other theater treats that you can take advantage of. Support this station, this cockamamie station, and we'll get you to the theater to be part of the rich cultural diversity that this town has, and keeping this crazy 99.5 within earshot of you. Here's Lee Wiley with the Gershwins, wrote this, and Lee Wiley does it as well as anybody could.
There's a saying old, says that love is blind. Still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet. He's the big affair I cannot forget. Only man I ever think of with regret. I'd like to add his initials to my monogram. Tell me, where is the shepherd for this long lost lamb? There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'll watch over me. Although he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome, to my heart he carries the key. Won't you tell him, please, to put on some speed, follow my lead, oh, how I need someone to watch over me.
Does anyone play Lee Wiley anymore? Am I left? Is that my assignment? You know, she's a funny take. When I first heard her, I was in college, and I had a couple of friends who were devoted to her, and I didn't get it. And then I was sitting in a tavern by myself, and on the jukebox, remember jukeboxes? I heard her, and suddenly the place and the mood and the tempo, and I said, I get it. That's Lee Wiley. I understand it. All right, a couple of other shows which we told you about earlier, and if you weren't listening, I want to know why. Did you bring a note from home explaining why you weren't tuned in earlier? One is Ode to the Wasp Woman, Sean Young, who was a movie star 20 years ago, starring opposite, she was the leading lady with Harrison Ford in Blade Runner and Kevin Costner in No Way Out. She was in Wall Street Journal, Wall Street with Michael Douglas. And then there was a reason. I remember there was a whole story. I'd love to find out why Sean Young left the movies. There are a couple of actresses like that. Diana Varsi was one. Sean Young, just height of their careers. Everybody wanted them and then gone by their choice. She's doing an off-Broadway play called Ode to the Wasp Woman. It's coming to the Actors Temple on 47th Street. And it's a play with four characters, all four who were part of the 50s B-movie Brigade. You know, my guest this coming Saturday is Foster Hirsch, who's written a book about movies in the 50s, which is really kind of significant. It's when the studios died and Cinerama came in. But there were a lot of B pictures, and Susan Cabot starred in a Roger Corman classic. Do you remember The Wasp Woman? It was horrible. And then there was George Reeves, who was the overweight Superman on early television, and then Alfalfa in Our Gang, and then Barbara Payton, that blonde and busty woman, queen of the B pictures, who was famous for her long kisses. And they're in a play called Ode to the Wasp Woman, and it chronicles the lives of four B movies. For movie fans, this sounds like a must. It's been done. It hasn't been done here. So you're on your own on this, but I think it's worth the gamble. We've done very well by I explore content and think what is right for what BAI people will respond to. Ode to the Wasp Woman. We have tickets Monday the 30th at 7:30, Thursday the 2nd at 7:30, and then Saturday and Sunday matinee at 3 o'clock. And the same for the following week. So if you are interested, Ode to the Wasp Woman, $50 to BAI, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And then War Words, which isn't coming to November 10th, but I thought you want to get a start on it. Michelle Close Brooks, who we talked with several years ago when her play Hitler's Tasters. That was a play about there were young women who were hired to taste food before it was served to Hitler to make sure it wasn't poisoned. And she found women who actually did that and then interviewed them and wrote a play around them. This is a play that is so poignant for right now. It's in the word War Words. Is based on interviews of men and women who served in the military in Afghanistan and Iraq, based on her interviews with veterans of the war and their families, composed of heroic and heartbreaking stories of the veterans, the families, and the allies of people who served, those who came home and those who did not. The playwright has felt that there was always a need for civilians to better understand the motivation and the sacrifice and makes to serve. It's called War Words, and it's coming to the Art Theater on West 53rd Street. And it doesn't start till Friday, November 10th. And we have tickets that whole first weekend, Friday night, Saturday and Sunday matinee, and Saturday night. And that's also $50 for a pair of tickets. So you have to email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com for that, hotmail.com. Let's go out with Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett singing, well, the anthem for this city. Michael J. Haskins, thank you for putting up with me this morning. And if we have enough time, let's go out with Frank and Tony celebrating this city that I love with every breath I have.
Well, you know what, David? We're going to have to go out with Harold Melvin and the Blue Note. That's one of the ones I did not get from you this weekend.
Oh, I didn't give you. All right, so let's go. Well, this is just as good.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach them
the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long. Judgment Day, so won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. We just let it be. No, 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 no. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Change it, yeah, just you and me. Change it, yeah, change it. Can't do it alone.
Hi, I'm Polina Vasiliev.
And I'm Ann Garrison. We're here to tell you that COVID race in democracy is now capitalism race in democracy.
We will continue to cover COVID, but we've reimagined ourselves as we broadened our coverage over the 3 years we've been broadcasting.
So stay tuned to WBAI at 4 p.m. Mondays for Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a little bit later on today over listener-sponsored commercial-free radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Any Monday with David Rothenberg. Love working with David.